Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to have Mark Roseman on the show. Mark is a historian of modern Europe and of the Holocaust, and is the author of a really terrific new book titled Lives Reclaimed, A Story of Rescue and Resistance in Nazi Germany. The book is a careful examination of here I use the word organization, and I'm going to ask Mark to kind of give his take on what word is appropriate for this. But a small organization in its English translation called League, Community for Socialist Life, generally referred to in the book by its German shorthand, the Bund. Bund was founded in the 1920s to inspire Germans to create a new, more ethical, and more communal world. The emergence of Nazi rule forced the Bund to consider how it could achieve its goals and even survive in a much different political climate than it had originally faced. As the members went about their lives and tried to envision a new way of acting in this new world, they strove to discern what living their ideals meant in a Nazi world and how to do it safely. It's an extraordinary story and one that Mark tells well. And I'm looking forward to talking with him about it. So with that, Mark, welcome, and thanks for joining us in New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Mark, we always start in the same place. I'd love it if you could tell the audience a little bit about yourself and about how you became a historian.
I am a historian, as you can hear, originally from the UK. I did my training in the UK, came to the US to Indiana University in 2004, and I've been there ever since. It's hard to know how one becomes something. One can easily invent narratives, but I can remember one really striking moment when I was, I guess, doing what we would call A-level, so that's the sort of last two years of high school. I used to go down to the reference library in Leeds, which is the city where I grew up. And somebody had left open on a table there a copy of the book The Yellow Star by Gerhard Schoenbanner, which was one of the first books about the Holocaust, which included lots of photographs. And this is in the 70s, just to date myself. And at that point in the UK, there really wasn't that much talked about the Holocaust. I came from a Jewish family, and it wasn't really a subject of conversation. I mean, I knew that the Nazis were bad, but exactly what had happened. And these photos, particularly the ones of after the war, of all the bodies being bulldozed into mass graves at Belsen, utterly threw me. And I think that was an important moment in making the history of National Socialism sort of existential.
I know you're part of a Jewish studies program in Indiana, which I know is pretty good. Do you want to take just a moment and talk about that program?
Yes, I have a joint appointment in history and Jewish studies, and since 2012, I've been directing the Bourne's Jewish Studies program. We are, in fact, one of the biggest in the US and in fact, in the world. We have the largest Jewish Studies major, I think, pretty well anywhere in the US. We have 16 faculty and some adjunct faculty. We're extraordinarily active. We have two centers, a center for the study of contemporary anti-Semitism and one for scholarly and cultural exchange with Israel. We have speakers coming in and out almost every week. And so it's been an amazing place to work and study and learn for me. Certainly in the UK, there's nothing like it. And it's very unusual here. And the Midwest isn't necessarily a place where you'd find such a thing. But a colleague of mine who's still present, Alvin Rosenfeld, sort of really got the thing going in the 70s and with a group of generous-minded backers from Indianapolis began to create, endow lectureships and professorships. And now there's this remarkable Midwestern thing with, as I say, the biggest Jewish studies major in the US with a large group of PhD students and so on. So, yeah, so that and then the history department makes it a really wonderful place to work.
So you say in your acknowledgments to the book that you've been working on and off on the subject of the Bund for 20-odd years. How did you discover this group and how did you get so interested?
Yeah, so it came through another book, which I wrote 20 years ago, which was the biography of a young woman who survived, a young Jewish woman who survived underground in Nazi Germany. And I came across her really by accident. For my PhD, which had nothing to do with this, I had lived in the Ruhr area, which is a big industrial area in northern Germany, and had got to know the historical community there well. And when I was back in the UK, a museum in the region asked me if I would interview a survivor who was now living in the UK for an exhibition they were doing, because they wanted an oral exhibit for this exhibition about her life during the war. And so I went up to Liverpool and interviewed this woman, a very formidable, impressive woman called Marianne Ellenbogen. And she told me about her life, but I wasn't working on the Holocaust at the time and I didn't fully appreciate the significance. Some years later, I went back to her to ask her if she'd do something else for a TV program. And she didn't want to do that, but she was. It turned out she was very ill and she had a document she wanted to show me and to ask me if I thought that it should go into an archive. So luckily I didn't waste time and went to see her. And she showed me an amazing letter, pencil written, 17 pages long, which turned out to be from a former fiancé of hers who'd been deported from Germany to Poland. And was utterly remarkable. And that was the first inkling I had that she herself had had an amazing story and also that her story was unbelievably well documented. So I started working on her life with her permission and I learned that she, for two critical years, had been helped and kept alive by this group, the League for Socialist Life. So that was my first encounter with them, was that they were part of this story of the trajectory of this woman who then had been called Marianne Strauss after the war. She was Marianne Ellenbogen from 43 to 45. And I wrote her biography, but I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to go back and look at the group.
So maybe we can start by asking you, what is the Bund? Where did they come from? When did they arise? What are they?
Well, people will know the word Bund, and many people will instantly think of the Jewish workers' Bund in Poland. So it was a common word. It meant league or association. And because the word Bund is also the word for covenant in the biblical covenant, it has a sense, it has at least a connotation of a very strong bond, although it can also be used more generally for a league or, as I say, or a federation. In the interwar period, it took on a particular meaning because a whole series of youth groups emerged after the First World War in Germany, which called themselves Bund of one sort or another. They were all understood themselves as tightly organized groups, often led by a charismatic individual, which were seeking to create a new kind of community. So that's, in a way, the sort of larger world in which this group emerged. Although the founders were no longer youngsters. Arthur Jacobs, who was the sort of leading figure, had been born in 1880. So when the group was created in 1923, he was already in his 40s. But most of the other members were about a generation younger, so they were in their 20s. It emerged from a group of listeners at adult education classes that Jacobs had been teaching, which were sort of holistic in style. And what it wanted to do was create a kind of a community that would sort of work towards creating a better society, a socialist society, but which also wanted, in terms of their day-to-day interactions, to practice being ethical. And they were very influenced not just by Marx and their vision of a socialist society, but also by Kant, the German philosopher, in the idea that you had to work towards a sense, an understanding of freedom, that you were only really free if you fully sort of incorporated the understanding in your behavior that you were part of a community. In other words, if you didn't find others' needs and wishes an imposition on yourself, but were actually already built into your own sense of what was good and what was right, only then would you really be free. So freedom for them had this ethical component of behaving right in the community. So from the beginning, they had this commitment to making the right everyday choices, as well as also sort of thinking about how to create the better society.
Do they see themselves in this term, in terms of this long-term project? Do they see themselves as aiming for something practical, or do they see this vision as a kind of utopian ideal to aspire to but won't be reached for decades or centuries?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, it's a bit of a mixture because on the one hand, they were very scornful about romantic idealists, and they were very committed to being in the here and now and being in an industrial heartland and engaging with the practical problems of today. And they thought a lot about people's issues at work, and they thought a lot about people's issues in their marriage and how women and men could be equal partners. So there was a lot of practical thinking about the here and now. On the other hand, they were not sort of politically strategic in the sense of thinking about alliances to change the system this way or that. It was much more conceived as a sort of long-term educational project that you would gradually disseminate your values, win over new listeners at lectures and events and adult education classes and more. So in that sense, it was very, the vision of societal change was very long-term.
How many people were involved in this in the 20s and early 30s?
It's hard to know exactly because when the Nazis came, the group burnt a lot of its material, and particularly anything that might help identify the earlier membership. As the documentation that remains for the Nazi era is really remarkable, and that's one of the things that really drew me to writing about them. But they did destroy a lot before, so it's a little bit speculative. But I think one won't go far wrong in thinking that probably 200 regular members and then a larger crowd of people who would come and attend events and so on. And they had groups. The central city was Essen, and they also had a group in Wuppertal, in Mülheim, in Duisburg. Well, these are all cities in the Ruhr or just south of the Ruhr region. This was their kind of heartland.
I was stunned as I read with the level of commitment on the part of the members of the Bund, but also in the kind of activity, the level of activity that the leaders and the group as a whole conducted, given how many. 200 in one sense is a lot of people, but viewed in a different way, it's a really small group of people. And they do a lot in the period in that community in the 20s and early 30s.
Yes, they were super active. They ran lots of adult education classes. They also took over a couple of elementary schools to try and revolutionize the curriculum. The Arthur Jacobs, the sort of founder, his wife, Dora Jacobs, was somebody who'd been inspired by new forms of gymnastics. She was born in 1894, and before the war, and then immediately after, she had studied. She'd been very inspired by Jacques Dalcroze, who was the person behind what became known in the UK and US as sort of music and movement, as new ways of learning music through movement. But in Germany, it took on a kind of and I think in Dalcroze's hands himself, as a sort of more broader philosophical sense of liberating the individual through new ways of movement. And Dora began to pioneer her own approach to movement. She created a school for gymnastics and what was in Germany called Körperbildung, body training, and Rhythmik, which is in fact what in the English language was called Eurythmics. And so she also created this school. And in the 1920s, she was educating pupils. And quite a few of them came through her school to the group. So they were also putting on public displays of movement and so on. And in that way, also conveying a holistic philosophy of society, mind, body, which also helped to win over some new followers. So yeah, they were extraordinarily active. And you know, it is possible that there were even more regular members. I mean, I was conservative. As I say, you know, I'm sure there would be lots more names that one would be conjuring with if the group hadn't been so assiduous in burning its materials early in 1933.
So maybe that's the next question. How does the Bund respond to both the increasing visibility and popularity of the Nazi Party, and then to the Nazi possession and solidification of political power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it was pretty obvious to everyone from around 1930 that the Nazis were a major threat, because they were gaining in visibility, and then in September 1930 they did extraordinarily well in the national elections and suddenly were clearly a major political player. So I think everybody on the left was aware of that. Some took it less seriously than the others. The Bund certainly was worried and were trying to bring the big left-wing parties, the socialists and the communists, who were rather bitterly divided, together and wanted to be themselves a kind of vanguard. Again, there's sort of that strange mixture of, on the one hand, you know, clear-sighted and practicality, but on the other side, it really wasn't quite clear what their strategy was. Nevertheless, they were aware of it. But I think they had no real sense of what it would mean for them if the Nazis would come to power. So I think 1933, when the Nazis came to power, especially a few weeks after when they sort of consolidated their control over local institutions and the police and so on, was an absolute shock. As you can imagine, lives were turned absolutely upside down. Very quickly, the group was made illegal. Dora, because she was Dora Jacobs, was Jewish. Arthur's wife, her school was shut down. There were raids on the Bund's headquarters. Some members, especially the members who were communists, who were targeted because they were communists, were interned for a few weeks in concentration camps. And so very rapidly, the group had to utterly reorient itself and think about how was it going to survive, and also what its role could be. Because, you know, obviously the vision that it had had was not that it should stay at 200 members, but that it gradually, through outreach and lectures and all these other things, you would gradually create a movement. Well, that was not going to happen under Nazi rule. So what was the group's role now? And that was something I think that that really must have hit it like a sledgehammer in 93, not just the sort of threat, but the sudden worry that they'd become useless.
Was there any worry or were there any cases where members of the Bund seemed to be attracted to the ideas of the Nazi, or at least some of the ideas of the Nazis?
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, one thing I just want to step back for a moment, Kelly, and throw into the mix is, clearly this is a book about an interesting group, and it's a group that turns out to be extraordinarily well documented. I don't think there's any sort of rescue group that's as well documented as this one, through letters, diaries, and so on. And that's part of what made it such a sort of magical and fascinating subject to study. But partly because of that, I also wanted this to be something of more general interest, namely, what does it do to our understanding of rescue and resistance if we have the contemporary records that let us question a bit the way in which we tend to have talked about it, which is very often on the basis, for understandable reasons, on the basis of later interviews and memoirs, and particularly rescue in Nazi Germany, rescue in the Holocaust, has been told almost exclusively retroactively. It's often with interviews with survivors and their rescuers decades after the event. So one of the things that I was sort of very conscious of all the way through in this book is thinking about what happens when you juxtapose contemporary records which exist here and either the general assumptions that we have based on memory, or, and that's the other sort of amazing thing about the group, is that after the war, the group itself laid down its own memories, in the sense that there's lots of records of discussions it had, of publications it put out and so on, documenting what it had done, but obviously as it saw it now in the post-war period. And so there's our general sense based on memory, but there's also their particular memories. And so this seems to me, this question that you've asked me now about groups being drawn, this is one of those questions which, of course, in retrospect for a resistance group, is one that we rarely encounter, because it's not the case that people afterwards want to talk about. They probably don't even remember the fact that there was a certain amount of openness in the early period, wondering what kind of a group this is. And certainly there were young members of the group who, sort of hearing the socialist side of National Socialism and seeing the ways that they were trying to engage with ordinary workers, thought that there might be some, you know, space in this new movement for them to act. And I have one or two, you know, very concrete examples of individuals who had to be kind of torn away, and of the group sitting down and really thinking through: is there anything about this movement that is right? And it came to the conclusion that there wasn't. But what's interesting, and I think what's lost from view if we simply look at the post-war accounts, is that they felt they had to do that.
So let's turn there, because you've used the term rescue and resistance. I wonder if you could start thinking about this issue by just saying a little bit about the experiences of Lisa and Marianne and how the group became involved in helping them hide and survive.
I think that for the first few years of Nazi rule, the group's main effort was kind of finding ways to sustain itself, ways to meet without being detected, ways to strengthen each other's sort of resolve and will and so on. How, in other words, to maintain some sense of an active a group and that wasn't stultified by the new atmosphere and could meet without being endangered. It may be that they did more than that. I know, for example, that there were left wingers on the run that members hid for periods and things like that. But I think that was the main thrust of their activity. Kristallnacht, or the Reich Pogrom Night, the night when in November 1938, when the Nazis mounted a huge assault on Jews throughout Germany, invading homes, beating people up, destroying synagogues, destroying Jewish shops, and then very rapidly interning tens of thousands of Jewish men to put pressure on their families to accelerate the emigration process. That was a wake-up call for the group. It had one or two Jewish members left. It had had many more, but by 1938, most of its Jewish members had managed to emigrate. It had a couple left. And as I say, Dora, the co-founder, was Jewish herself. From this point on, the group begins to reach out to do what it can to help Jews in the region where the groups were based. And one of the things I think I wanted to bring out was, you know, you mentioned Marianne and Lisa. These are two women who were helped by the group to survive over a long term. And of course, that's in some ways the climax of their story, the people whose lives they saved through the long-term help. But I wanted to render visible something I think that we often forget, which is that often such actions were preceded by, and actually in many ways not so different from, a much larger palette of gestures of help, which could be, well, like the example that I begin the book with is someone who, after Kristallnacht, turned up at the home of some Jewish acquaintances, which had been utterly gutted by the assault in November, with a bouquet of flowers. She had to brave a mob that was still outside the house. She sort of fought her way in, and obviously, I mean, had no sense beforehand that the house was so destroyed there was probably nowhere to even put down the flowers. I doubt there was a vase still intact, or a vase, as you would say, still intact. But nevertheless, a simple gesture of solidarity. That kind of thing, and then over time it becomes more extensive. I think one of the most important things that the group does, for example, is it sends parcels, I would say thousands of parcels, containing small amounts of foodstuffs or clothing and so on, to Jews who'd been deported to Poland, and after they were no longer able to receive them, then to Theresienstadt. It continued until late to be able to send parcels to the ghetto stroke concentration camp in Theresienstadt. And of course, these were immensely significant, not only in supplying much needed goods that recipients could either consume or barter, but also in the sort of boost of morale that that such parcels mm-hmm. gave in saying, you know, you're not forgotten.
The reaction I had when I read about that, and I suspect the listeners' reactions, how is that possible? How do they not get arrested?
I know. It's really amazing. It's really amazing. So, for example, you know, it was possible to go to a German post office with a parcel that was addressed to someone in Poland, and the post would deliver it. Or Theresienstadt, and the post delivered it. And I think the group kept being surprised by what it discovered was possible. Helping Jews was not openly criminalized until October 1941, although, you know, you would come under a lot of mm-hmm. pressure and could be subject to violence and all that. But from October 1941, it was, and in terms of an ordinance that sort of bypassed the court, so that meant you were then in the hands of the Gestapo. And there are people in Germany who were killed or others imprisoned in concentration camps for helping Jews. So there were very real risks that you were running, but at the same time, it turned out that if you were willing to take risks and you had the nerve, and I think it was very important that there was a group involved and not just one individual. In other words, that they could strengthen each mm-hmm. other's resolve, that they could provide communal resources, and so on. That it was surprising what was possible. So, for example, you know, there was a woman that they made connection with via a rabbi in Duisburg who had connections with Jews who'd been deported early on from Eastern Germany into Poland. And so they had the name of someone who they used as that they wrote to, and she would distribute goods to those in need around her. And she would write back to several different names and addresses so that the correspondence didn't always go to one person, and therefore it wasn't kind of so visible or obvious that this was the sustained connection. So there too, the network and the group make something possible. But it's still remarkable what you could do.
So let me back up. Actually, I just interviewed Evgeny Finkel, who wrote a book.
Yes,
the listeners haven't heard the interview about reasons why individual Jews made specific kind of choices about how they would respond to Nazi oppression in Poland and in ghettos in particular. And he makes a point about the importance of pre-war experience of repression in creating the possibilities for Jews in ghettos or around ghettos to participate in resistance or evasion. That doesn't seem mm-hmm. to actually apply to the Bund. They seem to have had the opportunity to act publicly and freely in the period before 1933, and yet they're remarkably good at exploiting those kind of opportunities you lay out while making sure that they minimize the chance for arrest or even simply the possibility the neighbor will denounce them and the police will knock in the door and find long lists of members. How does the Bund successfully make that transition point?
Well, of course, they're not a Jewish group, and they had some Jewish members. So in some ways, the context is different. But in other words, I think his book is helpful because I think one of the things that he argues very strongly is that groups that had ghettos where there'd been stronger pre-existing connections mm-hmm. to the Polish community before mm-hmm. the war tended to do worse when it came to engaging in outright mm-hmm. resistance, because their instincts and their connections meant that they were... I seem to remember, if that's right, it's sometimes since I read the book, but I seem to remember that, in other words, that there's something about the sort of acculturation that actually when it comes to your instinct to form an active resistance, in other words, not to be seduced or to be somehow betrayed mm-hmm. into cooperating with a system that's going to destroy you, that was very significant. That pre-war mm-hmm. history was very determinative mm-hmm. about whether ghettos would develop a strategy for, and in some ways, I do think that's relevant here, but in a way that backs up your question, namely that the Bund was of course a German group, and so the pressure to fit in, the pressure to, for example, be loyal during the war, not to rock the boat when Germany was at war, those kinds of pressures of neighbors who were supporting our government, our troops in the field, and all those pressures was enormous. And I think that's why so few groups like mm-hmm. the Bund managed to maintain their resolve, maintain their identity, and not be betrayed through friends, neighbors, acquaintances, or others who feel that what they're doing is a national betrayal mm. or illegal or whatever. So I think you're in some way you're right that his book, if you like, accentuates mm. one's surprise at their ability. Mm-hmm. to nonetheless, and I think it's not so much, it's partly about how were they able to act, but it's above all about that act of will that was required to recognize that everything that's going on around you is actually wrong, that although you're breaking the law, it's the law that really should be illegal, and you're the people who are actually in the right. I think that really took an enormous act of will. I think it was easier for a group than an individual, but not easy for a group either. And, you know, many of the members of this group, although the group was hostile to organized religion, many of the members of the group came from fairly pious backgrounds, from sort of the sort of Protestant regions, pietistic regions in Wuppertal. And I think there is something, a sort of transmuted sense of religious conviction, which is helping to create this moral sense of purpose. They do sometimes look a bit like a sect, although they saw themselves very much as a political grouping. And I think that was very helpful in maintaining that resolve, even when there's so many pressures round about to go with the regime, accept its terms, and not to be wishing for German defeat, which they certainly were.
So you've laid out there and in the book a kind of a thoughtful set of explanations for why people in the Bund acted to assist, whether you want to call that rescue or resist or whatever, and maybe you can address that. But can you say a little bit about how historians and others have, and in the past, tried to explain choices to rescue and resist, and how your study meshes or supplements or contradicts some of those explanations?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you say, I think there's a number of different things wrapped up in that. One is how do you explain what makes a group tick and what it's able to do and what it chooses to do. But another is what kind of labels do you use for it? What do you regard as resistance and should we be calling it rescue and so on? And when it comes to resistance, I think there's been, over the last decades, a very sort of sophisticated discussion about what exactly we might mean by resistance. So, for example, do we mean a group that's actively trying to topple the regime, which would be a perfectly legitimate way to use the word. And if that were the case, then clearly this group that I'm looking at was not doing that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were cautious even to circulate leaflets because they recognized that when you put up leaflets, it attracted attention and very often and very rapidly led to the downfall of the group that had done it. So they are very cautious in that way. If resistance means simply not quite going with the flow, like electrical resistance, you make it a little bit hard for the current to go down the wire, that seems a little bit a modest way of describing what they did. I think it's, you know, sometimes used, people talk about inner emigration, mm-hmm. or, you know, where individuals or groups had maintained in their hearts a space that was definitely not Nazi. That seems entirely inadequate to describe what the group did. So, and I think over the last sort of, say, a couple of decades, there's sort of been a discussion that captures the array of possibilities of nonconformity, of active opposition, of humanitarian resistance, which you might convey what they're doing, and so on. But when it comes to rescue as a term, I think perhaps we've been a little bit less good at thinking through what that might mean. And I think we've tended, first of all, we've often tended to conceptualize it very much as an individual act, so that somebody out of the goodness of their heart has rescued another. That certainly does happen, but I think in the German context particularly, one should very often be thinking about more or less informal networks that are involved. It's very rare that somebody's able to help entirely on their own. They're almost always in some ways dependent on passive or active assistance of others. So there's the individual side. But there's also, I think, the problem with rescue is that it tends to make the recipient of help rather passive. Mm. So you think of somebody who's struggling in the river being pulled out to the riverbank from the seething maelstrom. Whereas in fact, you mentioned the examples of Lisa Jakob and Marianne Strauss, two of the people who were helped for the longest time to survive underground by the group. They had to be extraordinarily resourceful. So without an enormous amount of courage and resource on the part of those who are being assisted, it was very hard for them to survive. But also, I think rescue implies a single or a very clear willed act, I'm going to rescue them. Whereas very often what we're talking about is chains of help. Assistance given to spend some time here, assistance given in some rations because the people on the run no longer have ration cards there, assistance in getting some false ID so that you could pass checks on the trains and trams, etc., etc., etc. So in fact, rescue turns out to be something that in retrospect is clear, but at the time, if you're able to look at what's going on in the contemporary moment, is made up of a series of gestures of help and a very active self-help and resource by people who were in one way or another on the run. So I think rescue is the concept that deserves to be looked at again. And that's part of what I've tried to do with this book.
And some historians and sociologists have attributed this to personal characteristics, the ability to empathize with others, the sense of living in a particular kind of moral world in which you need to live up to religious standards. How does the explanation you've given for the willingness of many of the people in the boon, how does that fit those older explanations? Or maybe what can you add to those?
Right. Well, obviously, if you're part of a network and your relationships within the network are important, then one thing you then can't do is simply explain people's behavior in terms of their own personal relationship to the victims, mm-hmm. because at least as important is how they relate to other members of their own group. Possibly there's also empathy there, but it's a different kind of relationships. And I think, you know, the group, the Bund in this case, placed a great deal of emphasis afterwards looking back on its philosophy. And whilst personal connections and so on, I think, were clearly important, I think one has to a certain extent, take it at its word and say, you know, clearly it's not just about empathy. Clearly people are being motivated by a sense of what's right and what's wrong. And the group, you know, creates a lot of pressure. You know, if the group leadership decides that you have to act and conveys a sense of mission and says, look, now you have to be willing to step over your fears, you have to break through your own reserve, and you have to reach out, then this is a very tightly bound group. This is a group with a strong sense of collective mission. Well, then you jolly well have to go out and do that. And so the group puts steel in your spine. And so then you're thinking in a rather different way about the dynamics and pressures that, and I certainly don't want to say that these aren't empathetic individuals, and and no doubt their feeling for their fellow man was part of what led them into the group in the first place. But clearly those individual mechanisms, why does one individual reach out to help and another not, it doesn't work as soon as you're thinking about, first of all, a group that has ideas and philosophy, so you have to think a bit about what it is that makes them tick. But also any kind of network where, excuse me, where you may be being called upon by someone else to act. And so at least as important is the fact that you've been asked by that other person and whatever commitment you've made to them as it is your relationship to the person that you're reaching out to help. So I think we need to think about these larger contexts, think about group action, think about all those sorts of pressure. And I think part of the problem, again, is that a lot of the work on rescue of personality and so on is based on interviews, you know, 30, 40, 50 years after the end of the war. Well, by that time, of course, people have had time to reorient themselves. By then it's clear who were the bad guys and who were the good guys. It's clear that the world now recognizes your actions as good actions. And so when you're being interviewed, in the context of someone where you know that they morally value what you've done. And I don't want to, again, downplay some of the fascinating studies that have been based on interviews, but it clearly is a very different thing to try and recover what's making people act in the moment than trying to build a picture of their personality decades after the event in the very different post-war conditions of looking back.
How do the members of the Bund remember their actions in the writings after the war?
Now that's it. That's really interesting. I think that was one of the things that for me was really fascinating about the group, was that one didn't have to stop the story in 45, mm-hmm. but one could look at their post-war lives and how what had happened in the war had shaped their post-war lives and how they themselves look back on what they'd done. And in some ways, it's a rather a sad story because they came out of the war with a sense that they really had passed the hardest test imaginable, and I think they had, they really had, and they thought that this was going to equip them to provide a real leadership role in, in rebuilding a better post-war Germany. And very rapidly, they find that they not only don't mobilize a new following, but they're really unable to win over a new generation of young people. And that they, in one context after another, they don't get recognized for what they do. So they don't get recognized as resistors, or at least have to fight to do so when it comes to sort of restitution and compensation. And then when historians begin to write about the sort of grassroots resistance in the 1960s, they don't get recognized because they don't quite look like the active resistance against the regime that people at that point were looking for. As I say, in the decades since then, we sort of revised how we think about resistance, and so on and so forth. And so they have this repeated experience of sort of being rebuffed, if you like, by the wider public. So I think the way in which they try and present their own past responds a bit to what's going on. So in the immediate post-war period, they're trying to talk up their active role as resistors and emphasize their activity. Later, they give what they've done a bit more of a spiritual cast and think about it in terms of a sort of the forming of an insight into the understanding of how history works and the sort of underlying force that's guiding the world through their tribulations in the Nazi era. So I think their own way of thinking about it reacts a bit to the sort of expectations and also some of the rebuffs that they're getting from the wider community. And it's only very, very late on that they what they did begins to be recognized at a point at which most of the active members had already died. And then I think there starts to be a little bit more of an understanding of what their achievement had been. And when I published the book about Marianne Strauss, which also, you know, obviously featured them a little bit, a book called The Past in Hiding, or A Past in Hiding in the US, which also came out in Germany, that I think helped to give them a little bit more limelight. And they were then finally, some of the members were finally recognized by Yad Vashem in Jerusalem as righteous of the nations. Although one of the things I do talk about in the book is that still fits into that very individualized recognition of the individual as the righteous. Whereas I think by then, you know, all the protagonists had died, but some of the children were around to see it. But I, of course, very pleased. But I think for the group, it would have seemed a little bit of a travesty because, you know, it wasn't individuals as far as they were concerned. What had triumphed was the group as a whole. So this story about memory and recognition, I think, is an absolutely fascinating one, but also, as I say, like quite a sad one because the group really didn't get the resonance and didn't attain the significance it really felt it had merited, with good reason.
So any study, we're coming to the end of our time, any study answers questions but also poses them. I wonder given your experience with this research, what questions do Holocaust historians or genocide historians or scholars, what do we need to ask that you're reminded of or that you're that are brought to the front of your mind from the process of doing the research?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I think one of the challenges that we have in writing about Holocaust, writing about genocide, is how do you write an ethical history without writing an overly moralizing history? And clearly, one sense that something horrific has happened here, and one sense of actions that are utterly wrong, and one's effort to recover things that seem kind of marvelous or heroic, are underlying impulses that that guide the fascination with the subject. Otherwise, we wouldn't be writing about it, we wouldn't be reading about it. I mean, those ethical issues are fundamental. And yet at the same time, I do think that, for example, the way that people have talked about rescue has really been hindered by an overly moralizing approach, which has really not enabled us to see the world of the protagonist at the time and creates a rather artificial sense of heroes that I think is not helpful. So that's a real challenge, because I don't want to say that we shouldn't recognize the heroic actions. Of course we should. But how do we write about them in a way that really captures the dilemmas and challenges and choices and constraints of the time, and yet is true to that underlying ethical impulse that makes the subject of value and importance from the beginning? And that's, I don't think there's one solution, but I think one has to be aware of that. I mean, for example, just to give you one example, when it comes to health, one of the things that really struck me when I was looking at the contemporary perceptions recorded by Arthur Jacobs in his diary in 1941, 42, 43 is anybody who reaches out to help Jews who are persecuted in the Holocaust fails to reach out to help many, many, many more people than they help. I mean, it's absolutely inevitable, because the scale of the operation means so your overwhelming experience is actually of passivity and powerlessness. Now, after the war, of course, we rightfully celebrate the things they did do. And I, you know, this is not a critique. This is not, it was impossible to do to help the most. So, but already in me having to say that shows that one's in a sort of moral minefield, because really capturing the experience of the helpers of the time is one of overwhelming powerlessness. And in fact, that overwhelming powerlessness, that sense of powerlessness, is an important fact, because the fact that one then acts is in some ways even more remarkable, because you might well feel, well, you know, I couldn't help 99 out of 100. Isn't it arbitrary? I helped this one out of 100. So again, I think the challenge is, how do we write a history of Holocaust and genocide that isn't obfuscated by our moral categories while remaining true to that underlying impulse? I think that's the real challenge here.
Well, I always ended the interviews with the same question. And so I wonder if you could suggest to the audience, and to me, I've got just a couple days left before classes start. is there a book or a movie or something that was meaningful to you or important to you as you were doing this research that you think the audience should read or watch?
A couple, I would say. A book, Nicholas Stargardt, The German War. That I found fascinating, because what he does using diaries and other sources is capture, if you like, the perception of ordinary Germans and how it was possible for morally upright, ethical individuals to feel they were doing the right thing in going along with the Nazi regime. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was very important in helping to understand the context which made what the Bund did so special. But I think in any case, it's a fascinating book. Capturing the sort of psychology of the population in the Nazi era, and very beautifully written and sort of sensitively observed, and sort of capturing subjectivities, I would say, you know, what are actually people thinking, how are they perceiving that? So this was really great history. In terms of a film, the film, it hasn't had such a splash in the UK. It's a sort of semi-documentary, semi-drama, sort of docudrama film, The Invisibles, about the German Jews who survived or didn't survive in Nazi Berlin. And it's all based on true stories, many of which are sort of historically well documented. And that really captures, I think, the pressures and the degree to which those who were helped have to help themselves. I mean, the incredible emotional strength and resourcefulness that was required to keep going, and the ways in which you would sort of reach out and get helped. And one more book, if I may, an absolutely amazing memoir. She's died now, called by Mary Simon, S-I-M-O-N. And I'm just trying to think what the English title is. The German title is Untergetaucht. And it's about, let's see, I had that in mind, but I've now forgotten the English title. Anyway, it's Mary Simon, S-I-M-O-N. Mm-hmm. And it literally translated to be something like diving under. And it's about a young woman who survived a young Jewish woman who survived living underground in Berlin. Absolutely remarkable. Now, that is based on a later narrative, but her memory is absolutely incredible. She dictated it to her son in 70 cassettes. And he was a historian, Hermann Simon, and then he turned it into this book. But it truly remarkable account. And I'm sorry that I don't have the title, but I say Mary Simon is the author.
I will put the title in the show notes.
Okay.
On the website.
Okay. I will say for
people who have not been listening to the podcast for very long, I had Nicholas Stargard on the show when his book came out, and it is a wonderful book, and you can get a taste of the book from the interview, and then you should go read the book as well, because it's fascinating. What are you working on now, Mark?
Well, a couple of things, but sort of the big project is, as I'm the general editor of the Cambridge History of the Holocaust, which will be a four-volume history with 100 authors offering a sort of up-to-date sense of the scholarship on all the different facets of the Holocaust. So there's a volume on origins and context, a volume on policies and perpetrators, a volume on victims, and a volume on outcomes, aftermath. And so that's a very exciting project, which will take up a fair bit of my time over the next couple of years.
I think that's maybe an underestimate, but working with 100 plus collaborators, you have both our thanks and our sympathies. But I hope at some point when, as you move on with that project and volumes are published, you'll be willing to come back on the show and talk about them. But until then, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate your time, and I wish you a great beginning of the school year and a great time working with those authors.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.